You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com.
This episode of the Women in Archaeology podcast is brought to you by Codify, a California-based B Corp that wants you to get involved and make archaeology more awesome. Visit ideas.codify.com and add your thoughts about improving public archaeology. Let us know if you're interested in volunteer or internship opportunities, share ideas for community experiences, or anything else that you can dream of. That's ideas.codify.com. I hope you enjoy this special episode of the Women in Archaeology podcast. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Archaeological Podcasting Network. Let's join the conversation.
Welcome to the Nasty Women in Archaeology podcast. I'm Emily Long, and I have Chelsea Slotin and Sarah Head with me today. On this episode, we're getting into the wonderful world of the 2016 presidential election. We're going to talk about the language being used to describe women and Clinton as a presidential candidate, and how this language is filtering into our lives as archaeologists, like the joking about Trump's rhetoric about women in the field, and the impact that may be having on women working in the field. As well as the potential archaeological ramifications of either candidate winning the presidency. Thanks so much for being with me today. So, to get us started, what are your thoughts about this election?
Oh.
I know, it's a loaded question.
Chelsea, would you like to go first?
Sure. I look at this election and I just shake my head and I really can't believe that it's 2016 and that this is what's happening. I mean, we have on the one hand a woman who is one of, if not the most experienced presidential candidate of the modern era, going up against, as a wonderful tweet that I saw from a Scottish individual, an orange orangutan, right? And the fact that the two candidates are being given, equal weight and unequal airtime, to be completely honest. Trump has gotten so much free airtime.
Oh, God.
And it's concerning not just because who's going to win the election and where are we going to be in, you know, a couple months with the inauguration, but also the damage that the rhetoric that is being used by the Trump campaign that normalizes sexual assault and normalizes rape culture and normalizes the reduction of women as human beings, and, you know, and reduces them to as Trump has described his own daughter, a piece of ass. Even if he doesn't win the election, which I'm going to come out right out and say, I really hope that's not the case.
Oh, God,
he scares the daylights out of me. The fact that we have given a platform for him to speak from for so long, you know, and the individuals who listen to that rhetoric, you know, I wonder what the long-term impacts of that are going to be of the people who are our children or teenagers today, who came of age when this was happening, and how that will affect their development. And then, I mean, from an archaeological point of view and a cultural respect for people of other cultures, of other ethnicities, of other backgrounds, the interest in understanding them. And we as archaeologists are interested in understanding other cultures. Trump wants to build a wall. He doesn't want to understand anyone. He doesn't want to know who they are. He doesn't seem to want to view them as human or as worthy as he is. You know, and it just seems very, his positions on everything just seem very antithetical to the culture of understanding and curiosity and acceptance, that I see so much in archaeology. And that also scares me because I'm all about acceptance and curiosity and tolerance. He doesn't seem to have many of those, and I'm clearly very politically, I'm very much on one side of the political spectrum.
I don't think you're alone in those words that it's incredibly troubling. And you're right. I mean, with archaeology and anthropology being a study of people, I mean, for one thing we can say about the election, at least it has been an interesting study in the extreme right. That's a positive in a way. I feel like I need to go to a Trump rally with a notebook and be like, yes, this is them in their natural habitat. See how they hold their signs.
The ethnographic explanation for this sort of behavior is...
a lack of reading and understanding and tolerance.
Well, you know, actually, as much as I enjoy making fun of that, I was just listen to a lot of NPR because I am a lefty left liberal. And one of the shows that I really enjoy listening to is called On the Media. And what they do is they examine the media and the media's handling of certain things. And the most recent episode, I think, was called Bad Decision Making or something like that. And they were specifically covering how the media has covered Mr. Trump, and not him particularly, but the people that are thought to be his base. And what has come out is that the media has overrepresented what is called the white working class and underrepresented the people who are actually Donald Trump's base, which are wealthy, well-educated white Americans, mostly male, who make more than $72,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So his base is not really the white working class. Those people fall very squarely into the Hillary camp and into the libertarian camp. So they may at some point have been Republicans. They may still be Republicans, but they're not his supporters. So even though these people may traditionally fall into the conservative camp, they are these people that you see on television who are, you know, screaming racial epithets and flying the Confederate flag. These are those one-offs that the media has found, and I'm sure there's more than just one of them, obviously. But basically what the media has been doing is the dumb shit that they always do, where they find the loudest, most obnoxious person, and that's the person they talk to, while ignoring everyone else in the room. And so at this point, we all have this image of, you know, that guy wearing the Make America Great ball cap, punching that black protester in the face as he's being escorted out of a Trump rally. And that's what we think all Trump supporters are like. And that guy actually isn't actual typical Trump supporter. The typical Trump supporter is a guy who's living the life, has lots of cars, lots of money, and a decent education, like a good education, who is just quietly funneling money into the political system and hoping to get what he put into it out. And I think that creates a very dangerous image because, mm-hmm. I mean, we think educated people are all going to vote sanely. Obviously,
you would
obviously
hope.
I don't like Trump, so obviously I think all people should be like me. But I like to think that someone who is educated and who has gone through a college education and been exposed to other cultures while in college, I mean, I think it's unavoidable unless you go to one of these very specialized colleges that only cater to... Anyway, my point is the danger here is that the media has created a false narrative that we have all bought into because we have no other way of knowing. Mm-hmm. The only way that we would know what these true statistics for Trump are is if you go to the exit polling data for the primary, and if you look at the polling data itself for all of the popularity polls that come out, and you actually look at the raw data. And that's where you start seeing who the typical Trump supporter is and who the typical Clinton supporter is. And that's where you start seeing the really scary stuff, like, if only white men voted in this election, if like some weird thing happened and only white men voted, Trump would win the election. The same thing is true as if only white women voted. Like if only white women voted in this country, Donald Trump would still win the election. It is bizarre. Those numbers don't start to change until you start factoring in minority women who vote pretty much, as far as the data that I've seen, for Hillary Clinton.
So I also think it's really important. I mean, as we're talking about Trump's followers, and it is oh so easy to roll your eyes and go, but why?
It's tempting.
You know, but back on the bandwagon of understanding and tolerance, there are reasons that people like him, and whether it is upper class white individuals who see, I mean, there's that old quote, and I'm sorry, it's a little disjointed, but that when steps are made towards equality, those who have privilege feel like they are being discriminated against. You know, if only three people are allowed in the square because they have special trait X, and then all of a sudden, all of the people are allowed into the square because we decide that we want equality, those three people who used to have exclusive right to space, you know, the square, are going to feel like something has been taken away from them because they no longer have exclusive right to the square. And I realize that that's a very generic analogy.
That's a good one, though.
But, you know, a lot of the people who are supporting him may feel like strides towards equality are personally diminishing their lifestyle, or you know, you do get people who are genuinely fed up with what is going on in the country and how things are heading. And if we want to learn something from this election, and if we want to do better in the future, we can't roll our eyes and say, well, how could you vote for that? You know, we need to understand where they're coming from and address those issues as well. You know, and that's hard to do. I mean, one of my dear friends, her husband is threatening to vote Trump because he's an anarchist and he thinks it would be funny. Yeah.
And that guy you just slap. I'm sorry.
Exactly. That's
right.
That's,
you know, and how do you understand that?
That's not a reason to vote for somebody.
No, not at all. But how do you understand that, and how do you deal with that? And it is difficult and tempting not to, but if you don't learn from history's mistakes, you're bound to repeat them.
And to build off of that, Chelsea, I mean, I've been reading a bunch of articles on how, yes, in a way, this election is unprecedented, but in other ways it isn't. And that if you look throughout history, you'll have these charismatic individuals rise to the forefront after major changes in equality. I mean, just look at the civil rights movement and some of the politicians that came out of that trying to push things back to how it was. And, oh, wasn't that a better time, even though it wasn't? And one of the articles I was looking at just kept saying, this is cyclical. We keep seeing this again and again. And they had 3 points that for the type of people who are supporting individuals like Trump, that they are typically only looking at the present and not really focusing much on the past or the future, that they're worried about their present, like, oh my gosh, my status, my stuff, it's going to change. Also, they're not looking around them and thinking of things globally and how things can affect each other, and that global connection on, well, if Trump is elected, what's going to happen internationally? And third, that a lot of these folks, they don't want to hear opposing views and they don't want to challenge their views. And so I think, Chelsea, like you're saying, it's hard to try to understand where they're coming from. But if you think about those three factors, it's like, well, if they're closing themselves off completely and going, la, 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 I don't want to hear anything else. It's kind of like, what are you supposed to do? So I'm guessing for the future and looking at how can we teach future kids about this election, ground them more in history, give a better history to show this keeps happening. How can we prevent it?
Well, and I think there's a danger, as much as I agree, as much as I agree with the repeating nature of this, mm-hmm. I think there is a danger in saying that, because this election is unprecedented on certain levels that should be addressed.
Exactly.
And it's not that I think people are being dismissive, the people that are saying this, oh, this is just a repeating, this repeats, we've seen this before. We haven't, we've seen similar situations, but this is not the same thing, and it shouldn't be dismissed as the same thing. And I'm not saying that people are being dismissive, but other people who hear that rhetoric do dismiss it. Oh, well, it's happened before in the past. I mean, we didn't blow the world up then. Why should we worry about it now? It's the same kind of arguments that they use against global warming, you know? Because, because it's like, oh, the weather, this, we've never seen weather like this before. Well, except for that one time back in 1894 when this one thing happened. Oh, okay, well, the world didn't blow up then, so I guess we'll be fine now. Well, yeah, but now the ice caps are melting, so...
There's a difference between a freak accident happening once and it becoming a pattern.
Right, exactly. And there is a pattern. I'm not saying there's not. And you are right. These kind of cult personalities do pop up after long periods of change have occurred. But the problem with Mr. T is his own party doesn't want anything to do with him. That's how freaking out there he is. Like, they're jumping ship like rats. That should be our first sign that this isn't normal. Like, Republicans will go down with a ship. They will go down singing the national anthem. They're not going down with this one. And that should be a really big wake-up sign for a lot of people.
It is also worth noting that of all of the individuals who have previously held the office that he is currently running for, who actually have experience of what it takes to be president of the United States, and there aren't very many of them, none of them are supporting him. In fact, they have all come out and said emphatically that he does not have the temperament or the experience to be the president of the United States of America, and that is significant. Worth noting. Yeah, regardless of their parties, Democratic, Republican, and they've held that office, they know what it takes.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break.
Would you like to get more involved with archaeology? Are you looking for volunteer or internship opportunities? Are you already working on community or personal archiving projects and could use some helpful hints? Check out the Ideas Portal, sponsored by Codify. Visit ideas.codify.com, a free and open community tool, and share your ideas, knowledge, and advice on select topics that will lead to vibrant opportunities and initiatives for all aspects of archaeology, from fieldwork to public service. All ideas are welcome, so visit ideas.codify.com today and make your voice heard. That's ideas.codify.com.
Welcome back. We're now going to get into the rhetoric Trump has been using and how that's been filtering into our daily lives. Particularly for me in the field, it's really getting to me personally that I've got a wonderful crew. Great guys. People I would never expect to say anything or repeat the type of things Trump has said in a serious way. The problem is, because it's so ridiculous, they're repeating it as a joke. But after a while, hearing, you know, Trump that bitch, and then you hear, well, ha ha ha, well then record that bitch, and that kind of language, it's exhausting. And I'm the only woman on the crew, and it's, I don't even know the best way to describe it. It's just, it almost feels insulting, even though I know it's not directed at me. I know it's not what they mean. It's just repeating Trump's words validates them in a way, or just, it, I don't know, it does. Bothers me.
It does, and it should bother you. It does validate his words. It should bother you. It should bother any woman. And I have this same problem with Bill Maher, which is a lot of the reason why I don't like watching him, and I don't. Just because you're couching something as a joke does not mean that it is acceptable or appropriate. And I get it that, you know, maybe they're trying to show solidarity in that, you know, they think the things that Trump says are ridiculous. And so they're trying to make a joke of it to make fun of him. But the problem is the words themselves and the sentiment behind those words don't go away just because you're making a joke. You're still using the term bitch in a derogatory way. You're still using it as an objectification term. It's still used primarily to describe women. So you're still using it as a way of showing that something that you're calling a bitch is not as valuable. And any of the other things that he says, especially things directed at like minorities. Mm-hmm. It's not funny. It shouldn't be funny. We shouldn't be using them as field jokes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got enough crass jokes out in the field. Do we really need to be adding this to the repertoire?
And maybe perhaps part of it is they don't realize there's that barrier where that they don't realize as women, a lot of times we hear that in a serious way.
The language that they're using is a joke. And I mean, I would sit them down and talk to them like this. I mean, yeah, you're going to get the mommy look, but whatever. They need to hear this shit. Mm-hmm. This is stuff that we put up with. It's calling your Stadia Rod, you know, the bitch isn't funny to me. I get called a bitch for no fucking reason. But I tried to explain this to my boyfriend the other day, and I love my boyfriend, and he would never do this to somebody. But I can literally walk down the sidewalk of a street doing nothing, paying attention to no one, and get called a bitch for existing. So saying things like Trump that bitch, or, you know, record that bitch, or whatever the hell, isn't funny to me. I don't even like using the B word in a positive way. I'm not part of the take it back group. You know, I'm not cool with the word. Because
as if normalizing what Trump is saying.
It normalizes the word, and I don't want that word normalized, and I don't want Trump's rhetoric normalized.
Anyway. I mean, it does normalize it. The other thing, I mean, from a, oh, we're just joking about a perspective, like, two, as much as people joke about cliches being cliches, they're also cliches for a reason. And there is that cliche of many a serious thing is said in jest.
Right.
You know, and great guys or not, and I'm sure they are because I trust your judgment about human beings. There are also people who are joking about things, this thing in particular, and do actually mean it in a serious way and think that it is now appropriate to joke about it. But I also worry about, I've heard some people using similar language and saying, oh, well, like, we're just joking about it now, but like when the election's over, it's not going to be timely anymore. You know, it is a joke at a specific moment in time. And I wonder about whether or not that's true. If you get so used to saying something, you know, and for example, I'm sure we all know lots of people in the field have terrible potty mouths. yes. Myself included. I can curse like a sailor when necessary, and you go out in the field for 2 months and maybe you don't see anyone who's not an archaeologist, and then you come back in and realize that your vocabulary is a whole lot more F-bombs in it than it used to. You know, and yes, you can renormalize to cleaning up your language and being in you know, more professional environment and things. But it takes time to adjust. And there are also some people who never do and just keep going on with that. And, you know, if it goes beyond whatever is supposedly timely and funny and just becomes part of the norm, there will be someone who hears that that isn't even, you know, a female who doesn't see it as a joke, but some guy who hears you and says, oh, great, this enforces the misogynistic leanings that I have, not realizing that you might be trying to make a joke or something else. So it just has these really far-reaching consequences.
Well, and there's some people that try it on. They use the joke as a way of trying language on. Like, oh, well, I made this joke. Everybody laughed. Nobody seems offended. Therefore, it must be okay. Or, oh, I got away with it this time, which means I can probably get away with saying it the next time. They mean it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're just using the cover of a joke as a way to have an out if you don't laugh, you know? And then they can turn it on you. Oh, well, it was a joke. God, you could laugh. No, I'm not going to laugh at your joke. I don't have to explain to you why I don't think your dumb joke is funny. You need to explain to me why you think it is. Why is it funny to call me a bitch? Why is it funny to infer that you can walk around and grab me for no freaking reason because you think you should be able to? That's not funny. Mm-hmm. And it makes me seriously question you that you think that it is. And then you get behavior like Chelsea had to put up with at her party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Backstory, since I don't believe this was recorded, I was at a Halloween event where someone decided that it was appropriate to basically hit on all the women, and when someone said no, just like move on to the next one, and then when everyone said no, go back around to the beginning again. You know, and if you're we were, a whole bunch of us were dancing in a living room, you know, and I suppose it was totally appropriate to come up behind many women and start grinding on them and grabbing breasts and grabbing vaginas, willy-nilly, which is not okay, in case anyone is wondering, not okay.
Ever. Right? Never.
So, like, I have very recently dealt with the real-world consequences of the normalization of some of Trump's language.
Yeah.
And it's sickening.
It is.
Well, and people think that it's just people shrug it off because they're like, oh, well, I'm an adult, blah, blah, blah. It's very true. This has been going on for a year now. I don't think people understand how long we've been having to put up with Mr. Trump. His language is affecting the kids that I teach. Like, I have to put up with things that Donald Trump has said coming out of the mouths of kids ranging in grades from 3 to 6. And I'm just like, what do you do when a 12-year-old says something that Trump has said? Like, I don't have to play with him. He's not the right race. Oh, what? You don't get an out just because you don't like somebody, and you don't get to say things that you heard on television as an excuse to get out of things. But that's the kind of world that this is a year of these kids' lives, and they're going to take this forward with them, and they're going to go to college, they're going to go to high school and the next grade with this mentality that it's okay to say and do certain things if you're white and wealthy and really great and do it in a bigly way, and, you know, and this is affecting things.
I do wonder, looking back, I mean, I've read and heard on NPR past examples of political ads. I think there was a great one where Thomas Jefferson was saying John Adams was a hermaphrodite or something along those lines. I mean, which is, looking back, hilarious. I'm sure at the time, incredibly damaging and angering. So I'm wondering if there's a precedence for this type of language, but it's hard to imagine, I mean, even 10 years ago in a presidential election, this type of rhetoric that Trump is using against Hillary Clinton being used towards another presidential candidate. Like, the lack of respect, the lack of just treating her like a normal human being. It's just utterly bizarre to me. And I think you make a wonderful point, Sarah, that this is going to affect kids. It's going to affect the nation's outlook, I think, in many respects.
And the way that other nations see us.
Yes.
Since our news media has decided that Trump is the story of the century, that's all that's leaving this nation as far as news. And so other countries see him get up on a stage and go, we're going to start charging our allies for upholding the treaties that we signed because we're not making any money off of it. They get worried.
Mm-hmm. And just rightfully so.
Right. No, they should be worried. But, you know, it's like what they don't show, or what they don't show enough, is Clinton going, no, he's crazy. Mm-hmm. We're not going to not uphold our treaties, and we're not going to charge our allies money to do the things we said we were going to do. That part doesn't get out there. None of the rhetoric, none of the counters that Clinton puts out there to deal with the crap that comes out of Trump's mouth, none of that gets out there. So all we hear is crazy man screaming at the void, crazy man screaming at a crowd full of other crazy people, crazy man saying something derogatory about some other group that isn't his, and you never hear rational woman explaining why crazy guy is wrong, rational woman explaining why we're going to continue doing the things we said we're going to do, rational woman explaining why we can't do the things that the crazy man thinks that we can do because he's nuts. You don't see any of that. And I think that is, an example of sexism, because I don't think she's getting the coverage she should be getting simply because she's female. The media has created a narrative, and you guys don't have to agree with me on this. I know most people don't, but the media has created a narrative about Hillary Clinton, and it is the narrative that they have decided is the story that they will tell about Clinton, no matter what. And it's not a positive narrative because the media has never gotten along with Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And so they go out of their way to paint her in the most negative light they can. Fortunately, they have Donald Trump to distract them right now, or else I think you'd see a whole lot more negative press towards Hillary Clinton over stupid things that have no bearing on her ability to be president of the United States.
That's a really good point. Out of curiosity, did either of you, both of you, watch the debates?
Oh, I saw the first and second one, and legitimately could not bring myself to watch the third one. But Sarah, I greatly appreciated your live tweets. They were hilarious.
I live tweeted all three of them, and much like Chelsea, I got through. The first one was just hilarious. I'm sorry. I enjoyed that one the most. The second one was probably the closest we were ever going to get to an actual presidential debate between these two. Mm-hmm. I had to bring myself mentally to the table to watch the third one. And I could tell that even just by the tweets that I did from the third one, I was done.
It was difficult to watch.
It was probably the worst one out of all three of them. And it was the worst one because it was unnecessary. Early voting had already started. So in general, that debate was not necessary. It did nothing. And this is where we get the nasty, such a nasty woman. Who the hell thinks that it's okay to say something like that out loud while your opponent is talking at a freaking debate? Seriously? Anyway.
There was a lot of shocking there were a lot of moments like that. Yeah. I don't know about you, I was just blown away by the incredibly aggressive behavior by Trump, and that even though the moderators tried to pull him back a little bit, I don't think there was enough to try to create a safe and, you know, rational, intellectual atmosphere for a presidential debate. And it bothered me that there was almost like this hope that he would go on the attack.
Because we have gotten used to TV. Watching. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's TV. We weren't watching debates. We were watching wrestling matches.
Exactly.
And it was like dangling bait above a shark pit. And Trump was the shark. Clinton was the bait. And he went for it every freaking time. Mm-hmm. I'm really disappointed that Clinton has to run against a person like Trump. Because, as Chelsea pointed out at the beginning of this, she is probably the most qualified person to ever run for this office. And she has to run against Trump. Mm-hmm. We can't see her demonstrate her skills because she can't. She has to stand there and smile. She has to stand there and pretend like she's okay with the fact that he is threatening her. That he is degrading her, that he is talking over her and trying to bully his way through her time to speak. Mm-hmm. And she has to act like she's okay with all of that because she's a woman. And I can guarantee that all three of us have experienced that exact same problem at some point, either while we were working towards our degrees or when we've worked in the field. You know, we all know exactly what's going on because we've all had to put up with it.
Exactly.
I think all of that is true with the farce of the debates and the fact that Clinton has not been able to showcase her her skills and her knowledge and her experience. And I have to say, I did not watch the third debate, and I know that the moderators had a hard time reining Donald Trump in. But I have to say, props to them for trying because he doesn't take instruction or criticism well. And given such a task, I'm not sure that anyone could have really been successful at it. So, I mean, they tried, and I don't know how much better it could have been. But one thing that has struck my mind often over the course of this election, and if you'll excuse my nerdy, wonderful, amazing, musical theater reference, Hamilton, right, which everybody knows about because it's this amazing show.
If you have not listened to it, get the soundtrack now.
And be prepared to cry.
Yes.
It's sad at some parts. No spoilers. But,
spoilers, he dies at the end?
Surprise!
I mean, we talk about that in the first song. Anyways,
sorry.
No, it's fine. I love that soundtrack. I think that there are two really profound moments in that show, one of which is the line, "Immigrants, we get the job done," which I think is a very poignant
criticism from Lin-Manuel Miranda, whose father I believe was an immigrant, you know, about the fact that our country and our success and the fact that we are a free nation no longer under British rule has nothing to do with building walls. And the other song that I find, or the refrain that is repeated often in the course of the musical is, history has its eyes on you. And I really wonder, moving forward 20, 50, 100, 300 years from now, you know, assuming that we're all still on this planet, you never know. Meteors wiped out the dinosaurs. but what people are going to think, no matter how this election turns out, we are living in a historic period. I mean, we had the first African-American president. We have the first female to win a major party nomination. We may very well have the first female president. And just how people are going to look back and say, how was that accepted? How did no one step in and say no, or at least not the people in positions powerful enough to do that? How did they let it get that bad? Why did it take a tape of Trump talking about grabbing some woman's pussy against her wishes?
And why does everyone think the most offensive part of that video is the fact that he says pussy? It's like,
right?
Yeah. No one gives a crap that he said pussy. It's that he was like, oh, I can just grab their crotches and their boobs and I can just start kissing them anytime I want because I'm rich, bitch. And that's the part that's offensive.
And that's the part that's disgusting and terrifying to hear that from a man who could be elected.
It's and like, the fact that he is oblivious in this the second wrong. It's the second debate. That was the first question he was asked. I forget the guy's name. It was the moderator. He goes, you do realize. Anderson Cooper says, you do realize you described sexual assault and you bragged about sexual assaulting women. And Trump goes, no, I didn't.
He's a kindergartner who got stuck with his hand in the cookie jar and is going to lie until he's blue in the face because he knows he did something wrong.
I don't think he was lying. I honest to God don't think he understands that what he did was describe sexual assault.
On that note, we need to take a break.
This is Christopher Sims, host of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. It's a show geared for early career archaeologists where I bring interviews and casual panel discussions about the challenges and opportunities that many archaeologists encounter starting off. So, if you're still in school, thinking about going back, just getting started, or want to take the next step, you'll find what you need to go dig a hole. Tune in every other week on the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Back, we're now going to get into the potential archaeological ramifications of either candidate being elected. Now, that being said, we did try to find something archaeologically related with Hillary Clinton, and really nothing came up. So trying to be fair politically didn't really work out. However, we did find stuff on Trump, particularly about the building of his wall that he loves so much. Found an article discussing how, if this wall were built, how it could destroy thousands of sites. Now, Sarah or Chelsea, would you like to get into this topic?
Sure. So it was, I believe it was Dr. Christina Kilgrove, who does actually some really interesting reviews of articles, journal articles for Forbes, but she wrote a piece on how Trump's wall would destroy lots and lots of archaeological sites. The conservative number that she came up with, which she, and this is a hypothetical math, that if the proposed border was to run around 2,000 miles and would be 8 feet thick, that depending on the location of the wall, and obviously archaeological site density varies depending on where you're at, but probably get somewhere around 126 prehistoric archaeological sites would be destroyed. She also is quick to point out that that estimate is a very low estimate. It doesn't include historic sites. It doesn't include artifact scatter in relation to the site density, et cetera. So that number can very quickly go up and in fairly significant numbers. And that is also not taking into account the infrastructure that would have to be completed to get to the wall, to have trucks get there, the need for roads, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, that's a lot of history that we're losing. I do want to get to the loophole.
Sorry.
Or if one of you wants to jump in on that, that's fine. I think it is important to note, however, that there are some people who say, oh, like, construction can be good for archaeology because when construction and archaeology happens, they could find sites, and then we have to, you know, have an archaeological team come in and work on the site. I think many of us know that the reality can be very different from this theoretical boon. You know, archaeologists don't have enough time or enough money to study the artifacts and the architectural features. You also have crews, you know, construction crews who might not recognize what an archaeological site is and you know, bulldoze through it because they don't have archaeological training, which is understandable because it is unreasonable to expect someone to be able to do something for which they have no training. But the potential loss of archaeological data is immense.
And for those who are not familiar with that part of the country, it is insanely archaeologically rich. There are areas that could just be a cultural landscape, meaning you can't walk several meters, several feet, without stumbling across some pottery, a stone tool, irrigation systems that were created 1,000 years ago. So the idea of even putting one bulldozer in there would create huge ramifications for that archaeological site or that entire area.
Well, and how much of that is going to cross tribal lands as well? I mean, these are supposedly sovereign areas that we don't have the right to just walk in on. Not that that has stopped us in the past, but my point being, in theory, we as archaeologists would be required to make note of that, and the tribes would hypothetically have the right to say no. So, you know, I mean, there's that to consider as well.
Exactly. There's actually, the article did mention, there are cases of construction for different aspects of border patrol. I honestly don't know specifically for what, if there were guard towers, parts of fences, or so forth, road systems. Areas in which the archaeological sites were completely destroyed, and this was on Paiute and Tohono O'odham land. The sites were Hohokam archaeological sites. So, yeah, despite these areas being sovereign nations where compliance should happen, it didn't, and these sites were destroyed despite cultural resource management laws.
And some of that is in the hearing that Christina discusses in 2008. She says that the chairman of the Tohono O'odham Nation testified in this hearing that the Department of Homeland Security allows archaeological resources to be damaged, and that they can waive laws that are supposed to protect cultural heritage. And I mean, Trump is talking about this wall in a Homeland Security defense kind of way. So, you know, what are the risks that no archaeology would be done? I mean, we as a country don't have a great track record of necessarily engaging super conservatively with defense mechanisms. I mean, we spend more money than, you know, the next 10, 12 countries in the whole world combined on our defense. When we talk about security and defense, people tend to perk up and approve things in the name of safety. But really, how much safety is it getting us?
Right.
And could things get pushed through simply because they have, you know, Homeland Security or defense attached to them?
Right. And I mean, we're just talking about the archaeological ramifications of this hypothetical wall. We're not looking at the actual, like, amounts of money that it would take and the materials that it would take. And I mean, the amounts of stuff that it would take to get this wall built doesn't exist. Like, we're talking numbers that are mythical. So the chances of this wall getting built are slim to none. But people really want this wall because they don't understand all of the problems that it's going to cause. And all they hear, like Chelsea said, they hear, oh, it will make you safer. It won't. It's not going to make you any safer. All it's going to do is tear up the land and destroy archaeology, destroy history, trounce its way through Native American lands, and it's not going to get us anything.
It might get politicians some points.
Yeah, okay.
Beyond that.
True.
You know, if that's what you're concerned with.
And as a politician, I'm sure it is. But, yeah, the wall, and I know that, like, Clinton has spoken out against the wall, not for any other reason than it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not ever come out and said, this particular aspect of the wall is ridiculous, and this particular aspect of the wall is ridiculous. She's never bothered to break it down, because for her, it's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people that understand what's going to go into, well, what would have to go into building this wall, it's very easy for us to go, oh, it's just ridiculous. But I think it's important to do what Emily and Chelsea are doing right now, and, like, tearing down aspects of why it's ridiculous, so that people can hear that and understand. I understand you're scared and you want a wall because you think that something bad's going to happen. You think drug dealers with calves the size of cantaloupes are going to run up into your yard and, you know, attack you. But that wall isn't going to stop that, you know.
And other aspects of the potential archaeological ramifications. It's interesting. I've heard from a number of archaeologists who said, jokingly, but I'm sure there's some underlying real concern there, that if Trump were elected, well, we're out of a job. And I think there is some truth to that. I can't imagine his presidency and then his cabinet members and so on and so forth, and there's a Republican House and so forth, that they would be particularly supportive of cultural resources and providing the funding to national parks to, you know, keep protecting cultural resources, or providing the necessary funding to provide compliance to these major contracts with pipelines and so on and so forth. So I think there could be some real concern that there'd be a complete lack of care for protecting and preserving and continuing with compliance for protecting cultural resources if things were to go in a really horrible direction.
Well, yeah, I mean, maintaining things like the museums where we store these things, or the research centers where we look at these things, or the universities that are willing to do the research and put out the analysis, that funding's going to dry up, because he's already made it clear, not on archaeology specifically, mm-hmm. but he's already made his stance on education and these kind of fields. He disdains them. So why would he send money their way to keep those up? And things like Section 106, and like a lot of states have that protect historical resources, you know, why would he attempt to defend those laws when they stand in the way of quote-unquote progress or someone's ability to build something? You know, so yeah, he probably would set up an administration that would be more than happy to either work with the loopholes or just get rid of these archaeological barriers to people wanting to build and expand.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted.
I mean, this is all conjecture. You know?
Right. This is just a big what if.
Exactly.
And like Emily stated earlier, we don't know what Clinton's position on any of this is. And I personally, and Chelsea, you can argue with me, or you can agree with me. But I don't think it's a coincidence that we don't have a Clinton position on this. One, I don't think archaeology hits politicians' radar unless, you know, they're representing an area that has a lot of archaeological resources in it. So I don't think Clinton is even aware that archaeology is, like, a thing. I mean, she knows what it is, but I don't think she realizes that it's a thing, you know? Mm-hmm. And Clinton is, I love Hillary Clinton, I really do. But Clinton is very much a watch and see politician. And her MO is that she likes to keep an eye on the public opinion on whatever's happening. Like she, I think, Emily, you were saying you couldn't see if she, you couldn't see that she had a position on DAPL.
Yes, and I mean, she does and she doesn't. I mean, it's almost as if just saying, "Oh, that's not good." But it's like, for whom? For which person? For which people?
And I think, I mean, that's classic Clinton, and that's because she's waiting to see which side is where the public is going to go. And I know some people think that's not great. I personally don't have an issue with it because, to me, that's her waiting to see what the population wants. And normally, if she sticks with how she's done things in the past, once she understands which way the public wants to go, she'll make it happen.
So I actually think that Hillary Clinton's ability to stop and wait and listen is one of her greatest strengths because your job as the president of the United States is to represent the people of the United States. Exactly. And having a politician who is actually interested in listening to the people of the United States is, you know, really wonderful and really incredible. You know, and I also have to say Hillary Clinton's ability and management and leadership style of listening to public opinion has probably also done her a large degree of good in getting her to where she is today. I mean, she started out in politics in the 90s, and it doesn't seem like it's that far ago, but even things weren't easy for women then, they're not easy for women now. And to stick your neck out on something that may not get passed or that the public is going to be very against are things that we see male politicians do fairly regularly, but it's not exceptional. And when you exist in a system and in a world where you are a part of the minority, to do such a thing invites criticism and invites the oh so hated phrase of, well, that's why women shouldn't be here, which is obviously incorrect, and it's a huge case of double standards. But I think her life has taught her that holding her tongue is the right way to go, and that discretion is the better part of valor.
I'm not saying that if she feels really passionately about something that she won't go after it. I mean, I think her stances on on the healthcare bill, she's always been a proponent for that.
And children's rights.
Children's rights, and her stances on education haven't really changed. She's always been a proponent for cheap and or free education up to a point, and she hasn't bent on any of those. And these are policies that are very near and dear to her. And I mean, if you follow her political career, you can see how she manages to get that stuff through, even though pretty much none of that is actually popular in the public. I know we all like to play lip service to it, but when it comes down to actually putting the laws together and getting that stuff passed, there's a lot of fight back, or a lot of kickback to those kind of laws, and she has stood her ground on those things. But for the most part, when it comes to things like DPL, whatever, when it comes to things like the pipeline, you know, she's a wait-and-see politician, and I don't think that's a bad thing. She's also willing to change her mind. I don't think that's a bad thing either.
That's an excellent quality, being able to be moderate, be able to try to see both sides. That's
if we all had the wrong. Same opinions that we had as human beings 20 years ago, right. I would be worried for all of us.
Right? Well, how about you guys? But I was kind of stupid 20 years ago, so.
Yeah. So, ladies, do you have any closing thoughts on our discussion?
Man, can I say don't vote Trump?
Sure. Why not?
I guess.
I mean, I'm going to be nonpartisan.
A thing that says the APN does not endorse specific political candidates.
Right. No. I mean, that is a personal viewpoint, obviously. I think Clinton deserves a whole heck of a lot more credit than she gets.
I think Trump is a scary option for a lot of reasons, one of which being the potential archaeological site destruction, although the potential human casualties are also clearly very great significance. You know, but remember it and learn from it. And man, it would be great if as a society we could do whatever we can to make sure that this kind of circus doesn't happen again.
Sarah? Give it 4 years.
Hope springs eternal.
No, I mean, give it 4 years and we'll be watching this all over again.
Well, really 3 years, because, you know, they got to start early.
I'm very cynical about political cycles because I have watched the last... Well, I remember both of the George W. Bush elections because I was unfortunately old enough to be aware of the time. And we are just getting progressively worse candidates from one side of the aisle than we are from the other side of the aisle. And it's, I think this particular election is, you know, kind of the gathering of all of that. You know, we've seen fairly qualified candidates being presented from one particular side of the aisle. And I think we will continue to see qualified candidates coming from that side of the aisle. And the other just is like throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks, and whatever sticks, that's what they try to run with. And it just didn't work for them this year. Maybe we'll get lucky.
They don't know what they want anymore.
I don't think they do. And if we get really, really lucky, you know, maybe in the next 4 to 8 years, we will have some viable third parties, and that would be phenomenal. But until then, you know, my final thought here is just freaking pay attention. You know, every 4 years is not a fresh start. It's an accumulation of all the crap that's happened from pretty much Lincoln all the way forward. You know, just pay attention. That's all I'm asking. Pay attention and vote. Don't vote ignorant. And yeah, that's my soapbox.
For me, what it boils down to is just be thoughtful of what you're voting for, whom you're voting for. I'm personally completely and utterly exhausted by the rhetoric used throughout this election, the just cruelty towards women, and the language being used that's, as we've said, being normalized. And I think people just need to be cognizant of what they're voting for and realize that there are huge ramifications for society if you choose a person who thinks it's okay to assault a woman, that thinks it's okay to be cruel towards other races, towards all people, towards everyone besides people like him. And, I mean, as this is an archaeological show, be cognizant. If you're an archaeologist or you care about archaeology, realize that the actions by politicians can greatly harm archaeological sites. So for me, what it boils down to, really think through your vote.
I know we said final comments, but I did have one other thing that listening to you ladies talk, I think it is important to stress that your vote does matter. I know that there are a lot of people who are tempted to lodge a protest vote because they don't like one candidate or the other, or they don't like either candidate. And while I sympathize with feelings of dislike and disgust on some parts, I don't want to see America end up in the situation that Britain is in now with Brexit, where you had people who went and vote to leave the EU not fully comprehending what they were voting for and immediately regretting casting the vote. And I know there are a lot of people who are disenfranchised with the system as it stands today, but your vote does matter. So don't throw it away, and don't vote for somebody because you don't like the other person when the reality of the life that that person may create in the U.S. is something that you also don't want, because there is no surety. No one thought Brexit was going to happen. It did. Nobody thinks, or many of the polls that I have seen don't think Trump is going to happen.
But it could.
But don't bank too much on that.
Now you can. Incredibly good point.
So now that I've stood on my second soapbox.
That's all right. Sometimes you need to.
Well, ladies, thank you so much for joining me this evening, and happy voting!
We hope you have enjoyed the show. Please be sure to subscribe and rate our show wherever you listen. We are available on iTunes, Stitcher, and probably whatever your favorite podcasting app is. Remember to like and share. If you have questions or comments, you can post them in the comments section for the show at the Women in Archaeology page on the Archaeology Podcasting Network site, or email them to us at womeninarchaeologypodcast@gmail.com. This show is part of the Archaeology Podcasting Network and is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle. You can reach them at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Music for the show was Retro Future by Kevin McLeod, available at Incomptep and royalty-free music. Thanks for listening.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, and edited by Chris Sims.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.